Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with editor Rusty Reno about a book that we feel should be on everyone's shelf. It's Philip Reeve's The Triumph of the Therapeutic, a classic of cultural pessimism from 1966. The introduction alone is worth the price of admission. You'll be impressed and maybe dismayed by how prescient Reeve's analysis has turned out to be. Then, the 2016 college football regular season has concluded. Bowl season is coming up fast. My team is in the Rose Bowl. I don't want to jinx it, but I do want to brag about it. So I'll sit down with senior editor Mark Bauerlein and discuss the enduring place of history and tradition in college football, and the increasing importance of stats and data, and the morality of football fandom. Do sports rivalries make us worse people or better? I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening. Rusty, tell us a bit about Philip Reeve. Who was he? And why do his arguments, especially in the introduction to The Triumph of the Therapeutic, remain important?
Reeve was a sociologist, born, I think, in the 1920s, 1925 or something along those lines, was a prodigy as a university student at University of Chicago. I think maybe studied for a year or two and then served in the Army during World War II, and then in some kind of staff position that took advantage of his intellectual gifts, and then returned, and he had an appointment as a professor at University of Chicago before he completed his BA. Back in those days, the sociologist was the queen of the sciences, and sociology was a big think enterprise to try to explain to modern man, as we used to say, modern man, to help illuminate the social problem. And the social problem had to do with the finding some sense of community and purpose in mass society in the industrial urban age, and the transformation from an agricultural traditional society to a modern industrial society. And all of the great sociologists that preceded Reeve and which influenced him, people like Max Weber and Emil Durkheim, this was a focal point of their work, to try to understand and then also not just to understand, but to try to facilitate the reconstruction of a functional society, post-traditional society. And Reeve's first book is called Freud, The Mind of the Moralist, which is a brilliant introduction to Freud's thought, keyed to Freud as a social thinker more than as a psychoanalyst, and which is really helpful. One reason the book, I think, you can read it today and profit from it greatly, is that it doesn't require believing, as many people did, that Freud had an accurate psychological science. Because, subsequent developments in psychology have shown him to be wildly incorrect about the nature of mental illness and so forth. But Freud was a very astute observer of social reality, and Freud, his basic theory of society is that society is given structure and stability through the imposition of some kind of moral order onto the id, which is the endless flow of desire that emanates from our instincts. And Freud thought that this pressure to, if you will, repress and shape this constant flow of desire has psychological costs of unhappiness. And that his hope was that modern man, through the use of reason, could adjust the level of repression to make it only as much as was necessary to have a healthy functioning society. And so for Reeve, Freud was a statesman of the mind, statesman of the soul, rather than messianic promise of redemption and deliverance from the need from repression, which is actually the way most Americans read Freud, as illuminating the dynamics of repression, which then Americans said, aha, if that leads to pain and unhappiness, we must find a way out of it.
So that's a particularly American misuse of Freud.
Yeah, I don't think European Freudianism ever had the redemptive promise that American Freudianism did. I mean, it's not an accident that somebody like Wilhelm Reich moved to America. Partly he was persecuted by the Nazis. But even in his early book in the 1930s, The Sexual Revolution, he identified America as the most promising place for the sexual revolution, which he didn't see as, Reich didn't see as a political revolution, but as a cultural revolution that would free the sexual instinct from the need for repression. And that we could achieve a kind of ecstatic, full, fulfilled existence through through the freedom of the orgasm. He had a whole kind of theology of sexual experience, Reich did. And it's those figures who figure in prominently in Reif's second book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, which is his most famous book published in 1965, where he looks at, I think, Jung, Reich, maybe Erich Fromm, and I can't remember who else, but they're all these redemptive Freudians who are redemptive therapists who think that through therapy we can be delivered from the perennial human problem of having to bring the self into conformity with social norms. And that for Reif, Triumph of the Therapeutic is a therapeutic, a traditional culture is a culture that sees human fulfillment through an ever deeper identification with the norms of society. So for someone like Aristotle, happiness comes from habituation under the guidance of a good teacher in the development of virtue. And that's the source of happiness, that's the good life. A therapeutic culture says the good life is the unimpeded expression of one's true inner self, say, or the unimpeded expression of one's desires, or so it's a reduction of moral demand on the self.
What are the basic outlines of Reif's theory of culture? What does culture provide, or what should it provide?
I think Reif thought, and I think for good reason, that reality is dispersive. So Heraclitus said all is flux, and so reality poses it's an open-ended possibility, and that the human psyche is Parmenidean, in the sense that Parmenides thought that, you know, the purpose of philosophy was to find the permanent things. And so we have a desire for stability and permanence. And so what culture does is stamps us with limitation. And limitation is something that we both, this is where he's wrong and Freud's right, limitation is felt as a painful constraint at one level, but at a deeper level, and I think Reif is right about this too, it's felt as a psychological relief that we have stability, constancy, and predictability, not just within who we are as in selves, but then the other people we interact with. So you have a higher level of social trust and a higher level of psychic stability within the self. That's the basic purpose of culture. And then the secondary purpose of culture is to provide what he called remissions. So the stamping is through the power of interdiction. That's the thou shalt not. That's the Sinai moment. And then the secondary moment is what he calls remission. Those are the yeses, the permissions that then provide some psychic relief or some psychic safety valve for the constraining power of interdiction. And so you could say that one example of that would be that for St. Thomas Aquinas to his students, you know, one doesn't question the truths of the Christian faith, but in the classroom, for the purposes of a deeper understanding of the faith, one has permission to raise objections to the faith. And that's a good example of interdiction, which is that thou shalt not question God's word, with permissions. And the permission is that under these circumstances, it's a good thing to do. And then other more more mundane instances have to do with every culture has some sort of safety valve for sexual desire or other taboos that, or you have Christianity with the notion of confession of sins, which is a way of reintegrating back into the interdictory structure so that a single transgression or even a lifetime of transgression doesn't disqualify you from participation in the interdictory motifs of culture. That's his basic structure of his thinking. In my own thought, he gives too much emphasis to interdiction, to the no. I think that St. Augustine and the Christian tradition more broadly and Platonism see the soul being stamped by love, so that there's a kind of focusing of desire on a transcendent love, and that limits and structures the soul rather than an external thou shalt not. But I think basically it's a view of culture that I think has a lot to be said for it, and the basic structure strikes me as astute diagnosis on his part.
Reif was employed at one time as a consultant for the National Council of Churches, which is a bit surprising if one sort of understands his background and his actual beliefs or lack thereof.
Yeah, he was a secular Jew.
I think you once described him as Moses without God.
Yes, interdiction without the consolation of transcendent authority.
Right. So, but he was hired by the National Council of Churches to do some work for them. What kind of work was he doing for them, and how do you think that might have affected his analysis of our therapeutic culture?
That's a great question. I don't know the precise nature of what his consultations with the National Council of Churches were, but he was hired because it was a time when, in the late 50s and early 60s, our cultural leaders were already beginning to recognize that the traditional structures of society were wobbling, and the leaders of mainline Protestantism were less and less comfortable with their traditional role as the voices of traditional authority, and they wanted to kind of rethink the precise nature of society and so forth. And as I said, sociologists were the philosopher kings of the 1950s, so it's not surprising that they would pull in Reif or some other sociologist to tell them what's really going on in society. But it was a traumatizing experience for him, and you see it in the first chapter of The Triumph of the Therapeutic, where he does have reference to theologians and religious leaders who, shockingly, are taking the lead in renouncing the power of divine authority to structure the human soul.
They're renouncing renunciation.
And, of course, by the time you get to 1968, the famous shibboleth, chalked onto the walls of Paris by students is that it is forbidden to forbid, the paradoxical prohibition against prohibition. And that, of course, is exactly what Reif sees already in the early 60s, percolating not very far beneath the surface of the clergy who, of all people, have the deepest investment in what Reif calls the therapies of renunciation, because those are the sort of therapies of divine authority. And I think that shocked him. I mean, there is an element to which Reif, when he talks about how, as I said earlier, that the self both resents limitation but also takes a deep consolation from the stability it provides, that his experience in the early 60s, kind of in the belly of the beast of this revolt of the elites against their role of being the sources of authority imposed upon themselves, because you can't be a voice of authority that you don't impose upon yourself, that their rebellion, I think, gave him a sense of disorientation, and that frightened him. What kind of world could we possibly create if we renounce renunciation? It would be a world where everything is possible, or where at least we have the illusion that everything is possible. And in such a world, he thought would be psychologically terrifying, not a utopia of freedom that we imagine it to be.
Reif was a very gifted writer, very gifted and often very oracular. I mean, there are these kind of mysterious moments in the
more so
the
as he got older.
Yeah. And there's a great little passage in the introduction to Triumph of the Therapeutic. He writes, "I too aspire to see clearly, like a rifleman, with one eye shut. I too aspire to think without a scent." I think that's a wonderful
trope. Well, he goes on to say this is the ultimate violence of the intellectual.
Yeah. So what does he mean by that?
Analytic reflection is a kind of asceticism where you deny yourself the question of truth in order to clarify what is actually the case. And this kind of renunciation of, I mean, it's a paradox, right? It is in its own way participates in this motif of renunciation, which he thinks is so central. But it's paradoxical because it insulates the soul it insulates our souls from, you know, the transformation of conviction. So this is a point at which I think, again, the Augustinian model of love as the primary power of limitation would help Reif understand what it is about refusing assent, why that is a kind of violence against culture itself, because assent is a kind of matrimony of the mind to the truth, and it's a kind of allowing oneself to be raptured by truth, and then as a result you cannot but be loyal to truth, which is a profound limitation, and so I think there's a lot to that. We have an academic culture today which prizes critique far more than assent to truth, but partly because it's so deeply skeptical that there are any truths to assent to, or at least any meaningful truths to assent to. And I think, and Reif has helped me see this, and I've written a lot about it, that the therapy of critique, I call it, is a therapy of apatheia, lack of passion, that postmodern men and women use to protect themselves from, on the one hand, you know, that painful experience of limitation, or on the other hand, an even perhaps more painful realization that there are no truths. And so if you just take the disposition of the analyst perpetually, you'll never have to confront the question of truth.
How will it end for us, this therapeutic culture?
Isn't it ending now? He thought it would lead to barbarism. His late posthumous book, My Life Among the Death Works, the title says it all. He's a deeply pessimistic man. I think his son told me that he told his son that on his gravestone he should read Book Smart, Life Stupid. And he didn't navigate life happily. And so I think if listeners take up his books, especially his later books, they should read with a certain distance and recognition that this is a very unhappy man. That doesn't mean that there isn't a tremendous amount to be learned from his brilliance. He really was book smart in a way that quite unique among his generation. I mean, one of the best readers of kind of canonical literature that I think we had. Someone like Lionel Trilling, who I very much admire and have learned a lot from, is a piker compared to Philip Reif when it comes to depth of reading and the capacity to make these pretty profound intuitive connections between literature and philosophy and art and all these things. So I do encourage listeners to pick up his books, but with a certain care, not to be led astray by his skepticism. But there's an element of truth that, again, I mean, it's some of his late books, I mean, it's Auschwitz is where it's leading to, and it's a very dire picture. And I think that that's not quite right. we live the barbarism is a velvet barbarism and not the barbarism of blood and soil. So it's a different kind of barbarism, but there is a way in which the therapeutic removes the burdens of culture for the sake of life. And life for well-educated, prosperous Americans today is it's pretty one-dimensional. You know, it's consumption, it's maintaining your health and your physique. It's locally sourced food, it's fine wine. These are not bad things, but they're not exactly, they don't have a strong transcendent dimension to them. And so it is a kind of, we are increasingly well-fed, well-educated, well-trained peasants.
I mean, it seems to me the therapeutic project is largely about dissolving, okay, interdictions, social norms, social forms, social bonds, all these constraints. I mean, that work, so much of that work has been done.
Right.
I mean, is there much left to do on that? And is it possible that...
Of course, we have to get rid of the constraint our body puts on us.
That's right.
So we can be either male or female according to the circumstances of our inner desires, wherever they come from.
Well, okay, so is...
Presumably not from our bodies.
Is the end of this project that will in fact be done? Or is the end of this project that will be the bridge too far? Do we see in these populist movements and so on, is that a symptom of a sort of pushback against the therapeutic culture that Reeve depicted?
I think so. He was very influenced by Durkheim. Durkheim thought that as social norms weaken, people suffer from what he called anomic horror. And I think that populism reflects a certain kind of anomic horror on the parts of people who are wondering whether they have any place, stable place in the globalized economy, in the globalized culture, in a therapeutic world where there are no set norms other than be healthy and, you know, try to get ahead in life. So I do think that there's and I think Reeve helps us see that. It certainly helped me see that.
Mark, I've heard you say that tradition is alive in college football as it is nowhere else in American mass culture. Can you explain that?
It's my example when I'm teaching T.S. Eliot in college English classes, when Eliot talks about the historical sense in his great essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent. Eliot talks about the sense of the past being alive. You know, something that happened long ago is an active thing in your head in some way. And I ask students, they have no sense of culture in the historical sense. And so I always try to find contemporary examples for them. And college football, I think, is a good one in the sense that I was at a Boy Scout camp the last year with my son, camping out. And there were two, a father and a grandfather there. I didn't know them. I just met them. But they both went to Notre Dame. And so I said to them, so what do you think of that second half and what Anthony Davis did to you? They were right on it. Okay, this was a famous game in 1974. Notre Dame was winning, I think it was 24-7 at halftime, beating USC, John McKay's USC team. And the final score, I believe, was 55-24. It was a devastation of Notre Dame in the second half. And Eric Parseghian, who was the coach of Notre Dame, I don't think he ever got over that half. But it was alive for them. But we, you know, talking Joe Montana and Joe Theismann for those of you who remember the '60s and football back then. The long shadow of the past there is part of the present. So that when they go watch Notre Dame play USC or Notre Dame play Texas, which was a big, big rivalry in the 1960s, the memory is there for them. That's tradition being not a scholarly thing, not an academic thing. It's a critical thing because they have the memories of greatness, great triumph, and great collapse against which they judge the present implicitly. There we have tradition.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I think that even today, though our historical sense is abbreviated so dramatically, the greatest scenes in college football, the greatest games in college football continue to involve traditional powers and especially traditional rivalries. Upstart teams leave me cold. I remember some years ago, maybe 10 years ago, Boise State was a thing for 2 years or something because they had a bright blue AstroTurf field.
Everyone knows that.
And they had some gimmicky offenses or something, and so they were sort of good. And I was just so profoundly uninterested in them. They're not worth rooting for or rooting against because they're just some random team with a blue field.
You're just not a progressive.
I'm not.
You're not innovative. You know, an innovator and you're a traditionalist.
And I'm a snob, I guess. But you know, but this year provided a great example of why I think my position is the right one. The Ohio State-Michigan game this year was a great installment of one of the greatest rivalries. It was number two versus number three, went to two overtimes, had a controversial finish. The fans of both teams profoundly cared about it. And the nation was very interested in it. And it was just a great, great game in a great, great series.
And the history contributes to that.
Absolutely.
The past is part of what made that present so special.
Right.
For me, it's UCLA, USC in football. We have our basketball thing at UCLA as well. But what happened in that in the last play of 1981 when they blocked that field goal? I mean, UCLA was way ranked very high. It happens a lot in the history there. And it is. It's part of what deepens the current experience of things.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the things that most gratified me this season was a small thing that, again, had to do with Michigan and Ohio State. So as we know, on Rivalry Weekend, which is also known as Thanksgiving Weekend, Michigan lost the game to Ohio State very narrowly and controversially. Jim Harbaugh, the Michigan coach, was vocally bitter in his post-game press conference about the officiating. He used that word several times. He was bitter. He was very bitter. 2 days after that game, on Monday, after Thanksgiving, there was a violent incident on the Ohio State campus. And the initial reports that were coming out about it were confused. They were saying that there was an active shooter on campus, and so people were fearing this might be another Virginia Tech situation. It turned out to be rather different from that. It was a small-scale but legit terrorist incident. There was a Somali jihadi who attempted this weird car and knife attack, which sent 8 or 9 Ohio State students to the hospital. And of course, when the initial reports were coming out about it, it was on social media, people were making stupid jokes about how this must be a crazed Michigan fan, somebody who's bitter about the loss. Maybe it was Jim Harbaugh himself come to take revenge on Ohio State. I mean, not too many people were saying that, but it was kind of the inevitable joke. But while all that was happening, the Michigan Athletic Department tweeted a very simple message: stay safe, Buckeyes. And I remember being strangely moved by that. Because here Michigan had just taken a bitter loss in a bitter rivalry. And, you know, for their athletic department to set that aside and just say the simple and obvious right thing in that situation was totally costless. But I'm sure it meant a lot to a lot of people who didn't know what was going on and were very upset and frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I happen to hate both these teams, Michigan and Ohio State. But that's an incident that made me think, you know, these bitter football rivalries, they engender a lot of animosity, obviously. The tradition, the history between these two schools engenders a lot of animosity, but it also creates these opportunities for a distinct and eloquent kind of generosity. I think that in order for us to have meaningful interactions with each other, we have to care about each other, either love each other or hate each other. We have to care. And that's one of the things that historic, traditional, even bitter sports rivalries. That's one of the things it makes available to us.
You know, you want your opponent, the one you hate, to be a daunting force. There are times when USC was down over several years. It made the run, and UCLA beat them 8 years in a row. It was fun that day, but it didn't quite have the zing for when these were both great teams. You want your rival to be worthy of the rivalry. And so when you've got something like a shooter or some terrorist nut on campus, you're 100% behind your opponent. Okay, this is like a desecration of what the two of you stand for in that rivalry. I mean, there have to be hard-fought games in which people come out bitter and angry, and they want to get back to it. But there has to be involved in that the feel for the nobility of the competition. And so, yeah, you're going to hold up the other side. And then when the game starts, you want to kill them. Right. But you don't want anyone else to do anything. That's where it is.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I think that athletic conferences are good, at least coherent athletic conferences are good.
Right, until all the mix-ups
exactly.
Kept happening. I mean, for me, it was the Pac-8.
Right.
And then it was the Pac-10. And then it was the Pac-12, now divided up into two separate conferences. And, you know, all the adjustments really do have the effect of breaking up the tradition. And, you know, it used to be the Rose Bowl was always the winner of the Pac-8 or Pac-10 conference and the Big Ten. And this was really meaningful when, you know, the Big Ten teams would come out and play in the Rose Bowl. Usually they would get beat, even though often they had the often better team. Ohio State came in as number one in 1976, New Year's Day. UCLA beat them soundly. Big upset. But yeah, it produced the conference rivalry. Now we have the bowls and the playoff. Something's lost there,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So. And there's so obviously a financial motive for infinite expansion of these conferences. So the Big Ten has been a misnomer for a long time, but the Big Ten now has 16 teams. One of them is Rutgers. I mean, the Big Ten started as the Western Conference.
Rutgers went into the Big Ten?
Oh, yeah.
Did the Big East break up?
Yeah, the Big East no longer exists,
in football.
I believe.
Maybe they still exist in basketball. I don't know. I haven't followed.
I don't either. They've been so irrelevant in football for so long. But yeah, Rutgers is in the Big Ten now, as is Maryland. Now, the Big Ten began as the Western Conference way, way back in the day, i.e. the Midwestern Conference. Hmm. And it's been expanding eastward for a long time. Now, what's the rationale for putting Rutgers in the Big Ten? Academically, it's well below par. It's bad at every sport. No one cares about it. But it gets the Big Ten network into the New York, New Jersey media market.
I didn't know that, but there you go.
Anyway, speaking of dirty money motives, Mark, what are your thoughts on ESPN?
I loathe and despise ESPN for a variety of reasons. One, ESPN is all in on all the progressivist causes and very aggressive about it. They also are so clearly about promotion of themselves and their own product, and by product I mean the televised game. And they really do try to package the sport into a media show. If you look at the highlights for ESPN on SportsCenter, or if you look at the ads for the upcoming games, all the music they have blaring, the players jumping up and down on the field after the touchdown, that gets more attention than the touchdown itself. The players jumping up and down, and it is so clearly a hype mechanism, the whole thing. that I just want to turn the sound down and watch it later when you can filter it down to 60 minutes. Yeah. You know, some stations actually do that, like the Pac-12 network. They'll give you 60 minutes, just the plays, which is a big improvement on ESPN. And I'll add to this SportsCenter. SportsCenter, which is hugely popular with young guys and with President Obama. I think it's his favorite show. And if you watch SportsCenter, just look at how much bickering takes place. The catty back and forth when they start contradicting one another. What's up with LeBron? You know, and it's almost gossip. It's like The View for middle-aged men. And you know, I just say, you know, I would rather go back to Dick Butkus, Ray Nitschke, Jim Brown, those NFL football players who were men of not few words, very few words. And there was no showboating with those guys. Jim Brown would line up on the field. He would say, "Give me the ball." And he'd go around and he'd get tired and he'd get up and go back to the huddle. When he would score a touchdown, he'd just softly toss the ball to the referee and run slowly back to the bench. But you knew he's going to do it again next time they have the ball. And I heard him talking once. He said, "This game, when you get down to it, it's man against man." But I think the big change here is the money. These players are worth millions of dollars. Ray Nitschke was never worth millions and millions of dollars. You didn't have this monumental ESPN 24/7 all the time. My brother and I, we got NFL games on Sunday. You had one game, early game, and one later game. Now, we lived for a couple years in Wisconsin, in Madison, during the Vince Lombardi years, and Green Bay sells out every single game, every single time. So we watched a lot of the Packers, and Jim Taylor, and Bart Starr, and Nitschke, and all those guys, and idolized them as well. But the hype, Ray Scott was the announcer for Packers games, and Jim Taylor runs a sweep around the side, picks up 8 yards, and all you heard was Ray Scott saying, "Packers, first down." And I run back to the huddle, and that was it. And it was bad form. It would have been bad form to do more. And guys certainly didn't make a tackle and jump up and do some chest thumping. And if anyone danced in the end zone, I mean that guy would end up with a bad knee later on in the game. Something would happen to him. So somewhere in the mid-70s with Mark Gastineau for the New York Jets and Billy White Shoes Johnson, who's a receiver for the Houston Oilers. I think it was the Houston Oilers, who started the whole dancing, showboating thing. And the players on the field didn't like it, but the networks loved it. Good for the show. And that's where the money was. So here we are.
Here we are indeed.
If you are a young guy in the NFL and you want to get on ESPN, score a touchdown, work out a little dance routine, you'll get shown. And you can see some of these guys, they've been practicing in front of the mirror.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the most egregious offender in recent years, well, Terrell Owens was really bad about this for a while.
Indeed.
And then Chad Johnson, who renamed himself, wasn't that his name? Renamed himself Chad Ochocinco. I don't even remember why he did that. It was like this made-up Spanglish version of his number, and he decided he would take that as his last name. But they're
brands. He's branding himself.
Exactly.
He's a package now.
Right.
Yeah.
But he would do these end zone celebrations that were clearly rehearsed, and some of them involved props that he would have planted. There was one time when he had planted a cell phone inside the padding around the
goalpost.
The goalpost, yeah. And then
I think I remember that.
Yeah, and then took it out and I don't even remember.
He made a call.
It was very strange.
Well, when we watch sports a lot like this, I tell him, now Jack, this is not the way. This is not a. You have, to,
not
be a,
how
you have
men
to be a good
behave.
Loser.
Yeah.
And a good winner.
Exactly.
Okay. A good winner. You have to be like a gambler. A good gambler, you never know if he's winning or losing.
Right. Get to the end zone and act like you've been there before. Act as like if, you expect to be there again.
As if you've been there. Yeah, you go to the end zone as if that's what you,
it's your
that's
job.
Your job.
It's your job to get to the end
and
zone.
And you've been there before. Right.
So speaking of evil empires, Mark, what are your thoughts on Nike?
The Nike is part of all of the hype, the packaging, the accoutrements that go along with sports. They're very expensive as well. And the Nike loves the guys who are good media. That's who they want. It certainly is the opposite of that that figure who ran a long, long way and, you know, entered the gates of the city and said, Nike! You know, that this is victory. This is not these guys. That's a different Nike. But certainly, you know, Phil Knight and Nike there in Oregon and the way he's turned the Oregon mm-hmm. sports programs into, again, such a multi-million dollar package, certainly contrary to the old amateur ideals of college football. You know, I don't think people like it. They still want to see college football have some identity apart from all the money. And part of that is, you know, school spirit, school tradition. This is where that historical sense comes in. Money kills history, right? Money kills culture, you know, the deep culture. We see that over and over again. When we see the whole Nike phenomenon, I think is just part of ESPN. It's part of branding and packaging.
For me, the great emblem of Nike's interference in college football is the way it started the one-off uniform craze.
Ugh.
With Oregon's, you know, so ten years ago maybe, Oregon started having a different uniform for every game. I thought that was very silly, but everyone else apparently thought it was great because now all the other schools are doing it too.
No, wait, not Penn State.
Not Penn State.
Well, I
no.
love Penn State's uniforms.
Penn State has the greatest uniforms in sports.
You couldn't get more basic.
You could not. Well, you could. So here's the thing.
Did they add something?
Wait, hold on. So, you know, for the longest time, Penn State had same uniforms, no changes to the uniforms. So for those who don't know, Penn State's football uniforms, black shoes, white helmets, plain jerseys, plain blue for home games, plain white for away games. No names on the jerseys. This is Joe Paterno's aesthetic. For a long time, though, there was a little extra, there's a thing that was a little fancy about it. And that was the following. It had to do with the trim on the jerseys. For the blue home jerseys, the trim was white around the collars and around the arm cuffs. The trim was white. And for the away jerseys, the trim was blue. And the reason for that was Nike apparently was not technologically capable of color matching the jersey fabric with the elasticized trim fabric quite right, at least for the blue. And so they basically said to Joe Paterno, it's not gonna work. It's not gonna look right if we try to put blue trim on your blue jerseys. So they went with contrasting trim. Toward the end of Paterno's career and life, Nike apparently got its act together and could start color matching the trim. So they went to Paterno and said, you know, we can do this for you now. Do you want us to do this? And he said, do it. And so that was right at the time when every other school was getting into one-off uniforms, and Penn State's change was to make its plain uniforms even plainer.
I approve. It's good.
I'm totally into that.
I mean, look, let's get down to it. It's not the package. You're going into enemy territory. That's what you, I mean, the metaphors in football are highly combative. Oh, yeah. All right, so let's get down to combat here, not fancy uniforms.
I'd like to talk a little bit, too, about the Nate silverization of sports talk, the infiltration of big data into sports talk. So, for example, ESPN has something called the FPI, which is the Football Power Index. It's a computery thing where they input a bunch of data points and run thousands of simulations of every football game before it's played. And primarily they're trying to measure what they call team strength, which is a strange and untestable concept. But they're also trying to make predictions. They're trying to predict the outcome of every game. So as a few examples, I'll mention some FPI predictions for the upcoming bowl season. And I'm doing this partly because I'm amused by some of the names of these bowls. So for the famous Idaho Potato Bowl, which is played on December 22nd, Colorado State is the FPI favorite with a 68.6% chance of beating Idaho.
Not 0.7.
No, 0.6. For the Motel 6 Cactus Bowl, which is played on December 27th, Boise State has a 58.6% chance of beating Baylor. For the PlayStation Fiesta Bowl, which is a playoff semifinal on December 31st, Ohio State has a 55.2% chance of beating Clemson. For the Rose Bowl game presented by Northwestern Mutual on January 2nd, USC has a 62.0% chance of beating Penn State. So that last one is obviously wrong. but the FPI favorite has won 73% of games this season. So I suppose that means that USC has a 73% chance of having a 62% chance of beating Penn State, I guess.
Well, you know, you listen to sports talk radio. I can't listen to it anymore, but I used to listen to it. These guys call in with these amazing statistics. I mean, there are all these people out there, all these fans out there who really love all these numbers. And the networks play to it, and the statisticians get into the act as well. Maybe some of them make money at it, advising teams on Moneyball.
I think there,
this approach.
It's also partly targeted at fans who want to bet on sports.
Right, right, right. A lot of gambling.
Yeah.
For that, indeed. But I don't know. I who has the time? The game's the game, and we'll go watch the game. But all this surrounding. I mean, I guess it gives people a language to talk about the sport, because they do want to talk about it. They do want to share it. They do want to opine, and they will debate. Go into a sports bar. You'll hear guys debating back and forth all day on Saturday and Sunday over these things. And you know, statistics. This is our biblical authority these days for debating. We want data. We want numbers, and it's a much older thing in baseball. Baseball's always been a big statistic thing. I mean, part of baseball is stats. For example, the National League batting champion is the one who has the highest batting average. The home run champion. I mean, a lot of things are strictly measured by statistics. But there are certain statistics that are magical also in baseball for a long time. A 400. If you're a 400 hitter, you know, Ted Williams was the last 400 hitter. Rod Carew came close. He was 390, 391 in the 70s, I believe. And people would follow the achievement in baseball much more by the numbers. You know, Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak. That's a magical number, 56. Babe Ruth's 60 home run season. That was the magical number for a long time. Football doesn't have those magical numbers. I mean, what is the closest magical number in NFL football today? Most people don't remember the Miami Dolphins 16-0 undefeated season. There are no, you know, iconic numbers, I think, in football. I mean, it used to be the 1,000-yard running season. But offenses have gone crazy now, so. But people search, they sure love to, you know, they sure love to compile these new crazy stats, like, you know, power ratings and all that.
Yeah. And they like to predict things. They like to predict outcomes of games. You know, and I think this is so antithetical to the spirit of competition. You know, I mean, every team thinks or should think that it has a 100% chance of of winning every game. And, you know, that's kind of the nature of proper fan engagement too, I think. You don't sort of modulate your investment based on the FPI.
Right.
You know, but this is, we're coming off an election in which it was very amusing to see the favored nominees' chances of winning go from, you know, 90% to 0% in 2 hours or something. But it's, I mean, but there are very similar things that happen with these football games where, you know, somebody has an 80% chance of winning a game and then they lose it. And so it's falsified. And so it was very silly. It was always going to be settled on the field. We knew that.
It's like a proxy for wish fulfillment, I think, in many ways. You talk about the odds. And you can express your desires through these predictions. And it's funny. Data is just data, numbers, totally unemotional. But people get very emotional often when they cite these statistics and debate over them. So I look at it as just a way to work out these psychic investments people have.
Yeah,
I think in these outcomes.
I think that's right. I think there's something else, too, that's going on right now with college football that's kind of interesting to me. So the notion that when two teams play, the best team may not necessarily win, that's a conceit that's always been available to losers. But it's an idea that people who take college football seriously now are having to take very seriously, partly because we have these Nate Silvery, you know, metrics about team strength. And people love to talk about that because they love data, but also because of the new playoff system, which is controlled by a committee. And the committee selects the four teams that will participate in the semifinals before the national championship. And the stated intention of the committee is to select the four best teams, not to find the four best records, but the four best teams. And how do they figure out who are the four best teams? Well, by crunching numbers, the way FPI does, divining auspices. It's a little unclear. There's a whole Kremlinology that's springing up around this ridiculous committee. And the flashpoint this season was, of course, the controversy over Ohio State and Penn State. So Ohio State is in the playoff with one loss. Okay, so what about the one team that beat them? That's Penn State. Penn State finished the season on a 9-game win streak, won the Big Ten East, which is Ohio State's division, won the Big Ten championship. Committee says, no, Ohio State is
what
in,
was Penn State's
is
final
out.
Record?
11-2.
Okay.
Whereas Ohio there State's final record is 11-1.
No.
So the committee says, no, Ohio State is in, Penn State is out. We just think Ohio State is the better team. And I think, really? Because when the two teams played, et cetera, it's fine. You know, I'm not saying the committee is wrong about which is the better team. They're probably right. But I'm questioning whether that even should matter. Because it used to be if you lost a game and insisted, well, we're actually still the better team, that was laughable.
Right.
Because you failed to prove it on the field.
Right.
You know, but
right.
the playoff committee doesn't actually see it this way.
No.
You know, for the playoff committee, nothing is ever really settled on the field. There's always more to talk about in that committee room, more to talk about on SportsCenter. Basically, they're saying that for teams we particularly like, we're willing to look past head-to-head results. And this seems to me actually unmanly. You know, if you're the better team and you lose, that is a moral failure and you should be punished for it. But also, I think this notion that head-to-head results are not conclusive or for select teams they're not conclusive, it's a way of protecting the stature of certain teams. The committee wants to put Ohio State in the playoff every year if they possibly can. Ohio State is a familiar contender. It's brandable. The matchups are going to be marketable to a national audience.
Their uniforms look better.
No, their uniforms are terrible. Ohio State is actually good with a lot of the traditional, the paraphernalia and the tradition.
They're good with a lot of that stuff.
I don't love their uniforms, though. I hate their helmet stickers.
I hate those helmet stickers. No, but those go back a long way. They started doing that. Did they do that under Woody Hayes in the 60s? But we always thought they were ridiculous.
Yeah.
You get a sticker if you do a great thing in a game. Okay, it's like, you know, gold stars in my son's elementary school.
For real. It's childish. It's fine. I'm not bitter.
You're not bitter.
Not bitter.
Just know it's wrong.
It's just wrong.
It's wrong. No, I would be annoyed as well because, yeah, you know, the outcome is what happens in 60 minutes on the field, not anywhere else. That's what matters.
Honestly, I do think there's just an interesting shift in the way we are beginning to regard the outcomes of games. And it seems to me, I think data play a role in this. There's some superior measure of performance or strength. We can get to a higher level if we run 1,000 computer simulations.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to me.
Which gets to the more true appraisal.
Yeah.
That there are deeper, there's a deeper evaluation than just wins and losses.
Right. That's so pedestrian. So old-fashioned. Yeah. Oh, well. Still a great sport.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Mark Bauerlein. Thanks to the College Football Playoff Committee for the fine, fine work that you do. And thank you, listeners.